apartheid state on the 1st of April in Damascus. As I said in the Parliament yesterday, not one word did the Prime Minister say about the destruction of the Iranian consulate in Damascus, in violation of the Vienna Convention, in violation of all rules and laws of the United Nations Charter and of international law. And yet, obviously, the events on the 1st of April were the proximate cause, reason for the events of last weekend over in the skies over the apartheid state. But not one word was mentioned until I rose to my feet. The fact that my intervention has now been viewed by millions and millions of people, when so many dozens of people spoke, many of them much more powerful than me in terms of the positions that they hold, the fact that it is my intervention that is dominating the public discourse proves something very important. The British public are not fools. They know essentially what's going on in the Middle East and that Palestine is the heart of the matter. The massacre of 35,000 and more, most of them women and children, trapped in a cage with nowhere to run, with nowhere to hide, with no anti-aircraft potential, no aircraft, no warships, no bomb shelters. Not like the bunker that Netanyahu spent the weekend in the basement of the house of an American billionaire in Tel Aviv. The truth is, the British public and the Western public know that their governments are on the road to nowhere, making ourselves more and more hated, more and more imperiled and in danger, our interests damaged everywhere by our unending support for a tiny little country of just a few million people on the Mediterranean. We'll be discussing with the first-rate, first-line, top-class guest, Dr. Syed Mohammed Marandi from the University of Tehran. This is Have It Out with Galloway. Professor Syed Mohammed Marandi is the head of the American Studies Department at the University of Tehran. He's become a very familiar face and voice in Western media because he's not easy for them to dismiss. He's not easy for them to rubbish. He speaks the language. He speaks the language of wisdom, of international diplomacy, statecraft, and the language of finding solutions to problems rather than exacerbating them. I frequently have the honor of having him as a guest on my shows, and I have that honor again today. Now, very dangerous times, Professor. Welcome to the show. Will this be my last show? Is there going to be an all-out war by next week?
Well, I hope we are all able to benefit from your excellent show for a very long time. I do think it's quite possible that there will be an escalation. If the Israeli regime says they're going to target Iranians again, then if they don't do so, it would be a humiliation in itself. So I think they've put themselves in a position where they feel that they have to carry out an attack. And this is where I think the West miscalculates and misunderstands, because the West constantly believes its own propaganda, like in Ukraine, where the Ukrainians were always winning, and then suddenly everyone sees that they're losing. It's because of the Western propaganda that has for 2 years been saying that they've been wiping out the Russian armed forces, and then suddenly everyone wakes up to the reality that Kiev is under threat. In the case of Iran and the Israeli regime, the Israelis have lost in Gaza on the battlefield. They've lost on the border with Lebanon on the battlefield. They've created hatred for the regime across the globe because of the genocide. And after striking the Iranian embassy, the globe was outraged. The European countries and the United States are marginalized nowadays in the international community. They, of course, support the strike on the embassy, which is seen as outrageous, just as their support for the genocide is seen as outrageous across the globe. But their propaganda basically has been that the Israelis won when the Iranians struck back and retaliated and punished Israel for the airstrike, whereas that is absolutely not the case. It is the opposite. The Iranians sent large numbers of very inexpensive and old drones, each costing at most $10,000. And they told the world well in advance, because the Iranians wanted to draw fire towards those drones. They wanted the Israeli regime and the Americans to throw everything they had at the drones. And that's what they did. So the Iranians spent maybe a couple of million dollars on the drones, and the Israelis spent over $1.3 billion in missiles to shoot down those drones. And they didn't get any intelligence from Iran because they were all old. And the Iranians gained a huge amount of intelligence about Israeli and U.S. capabilities. And of course, they depleted their reserves of drones, whereas Iran has endless amounts of drones and missiles. Then the Iranians fired a number of older missiles, again, no new technology, getting rid of these old missiles. They also were, like the drones, fired to draw the anti-aircraft missiles towards themselves, and they were successful as well. So these drones and those older missiles, which had, as I said, no new technology in them for the West or Israel to discover, they all fulfilled their objective. They made, they forced the other side to carry out a costly missile attack on the drones and missiles, and they gathered a huge amount of information. So they were decoys. They were all decoys. Then, to send the real message to Israel, they sent a handful, maybe 10 to 20, I'm not quite sure about the number, of missiles to an airbase in the south, where the F-35s are, which bombed Gaza and which bombed the embassy, and a military intelligence base in the north. Those drones, those missiles all got through. Even those missiles weren't Iran's latest technology. They were older missiles, but they went right through the defense, and they showed the Israeli regime, and there's footage of them. There's footage, at least a number of drones and satellite. There's footage of the drones striking and satellite pictures showing that they struck. So it was a success from the Iranian point of view. But the problem is that when the West puts out this propaganda, as usual, they believe their own propaganda. And I think that may actually help to create miscalculation. And then this time around, if the Israelis strike, which they've threatened to do, the Iranians will hit back much harder. It will not be like what we saw 2-3 days ago. The Iranians have gathered their intelligence. The number of drones and missiles will be much greater. They will not be giving days of telling everyone days before that they're going to carry out the attack. It will be a sudden counterstrike if the Israeli regime does anything. And there will be thousands instead of hundreds. So the Israeli regime will be devastated. The Iranians have promised to give a crushing response this time around. So if the Americans and the Israelis keep gloating, then they may do something very stupid. And then they'll see the reality of Iran's capabilities.
We'll explore the likely meaning of that reality in a minute, Professor. David Cameron, when asked on Sky News in the unlikely figure of Kay Burley, who became the biggest journalist in the country with this question. When Cameron was fulminating about what Iran had done in response to the attack on its embassy, he was asked by Kay Burley, well, what would Britain do if such a thing happened to one of our embassies? And he more or less said, we'd do exactly the same as Iran has done, a real parade, Professor, of hypocrisy. But let's move on from them and talk about you, talk about Iran. I think there's a very strong case for saying, as George W. Bush might have put it, that they've all misunderestimated Iran. They think of Iran as some kind of, I don't know, a Victorian-era northwest frontier province. But the reality is, Iran is a real substantial military power with 41 million people of fighting age, as opposed to 3 million people of fighting age in the apartheid state. Do you think they have, that this all stems from an underestimation of Iranian capability?
Yes, I think that they forget that even after the collapse of the Soviet Union and after the U.S. victory in Kuwait over the foolish Saddam Hussein, when the United States was at the top of the world and they became what someone once called a hyperpower, and we had reached supposedly the end of history, as Fukuyama said. Back then, the United States never dared to attack Iran because Iran was much more powerful than Iraq or Afghanistan. In the 90s, they didn't do it. After they invaded Afghanistan and Iraq, they didn't do it because Iran was simply too powerful. And the ideology that dominates Iranian society, especially this the view, this religious ideology, and this the way in which people in Iran view Karbala and Imam Hussein, the Americans know that there would be, they always knew that there would be many people who would stand against their aggression, and ultimately that the Americans would lose. The Iranians would be highly motivated in the defense of the Islamic Republic of Iran. And so the Americans always constantly threatened the country, but they always stood back and were careful not to enter Iranian territory. That was then. But this is now. Iran today is much more powerful. It has developed a very high-tech military industry. The West claims that Iran is assisting the Russians in and giving them advanced technology to fight their war in Ukraine. Whether it's true or false is irrelevant. The point is that they acknowledge Iran's advanced capabilities, its advanced technology, its advanced weapons system, the systems that have been developed indigenously. And Iran today has allies across the region. Back then, Iran was isolated. And after the Americans invaded Iran and Iraq and Afghanistan, Iran was surrounded by American bases and American soldiers. But today, Iran has allies in Iraq, in Syria, in Lebanon, in Yemen, and the U.S. allies across the region are despised because their own population, their populations are witnessing a genocide in Gaza take place in front of our eyes as we speak, but their regimes do nothing if not support the Israelis directly or indirectly carry out the genocide. So these regimes are becoming increasingly vulnerable. Those that do trade with Israel, those who do business or who have political contacts or who have military cooperation, they are losing their legitimacy in the eyes of their own people. Indeed, even in Turkey, despite the rhetoric of the president, we've seen how Turkey has continued to do business as usual with the Israeli regime, provided with fuel from the Caucasus and Central Asia, export and import goods. And where did that lead the president of Turkey, Mr. Erdogan, during the local elections? He was wiped out. Why? Because many of his supporters went and voted for other parties, both religious and secular. So those that are siding with Israel are growing weaker. Those that are siding with the resistance are growing stronger. And the resistance is not just Iran and those and its partners in Yemen and Lebanon and elsewhere. The resistance is growing across the world. The global south has turned against Israel. And we see that young people and people from all walks of life in the West have turned against Israel. Young Jews, young Christians, young Muslims, young Hindus, people from different walks of life. They are now a part of this broader resistance against genocide, against what the Brazilian president called the Holocaust, effectively. And I think that the isolation of Israel and its regional friends will increase, and the isolation of the West will increase, and that puts Iran and the resistance in a commanding position.
Indeed so. Professor Marandi, as always, thank you for that tour of the horizon. Let's go to Zebonisa Rao in London. Zebonisa, welcome.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here, and greetings to everyone. So my question is a mixture of kind of frustration, complaint, and finally a question. It's a follow-up to your last program where it was mentioned the greed of governments and the Pope being Catholic discussion. Mm-hmm. So we've witnessed a six-month-long genocide. We spent every day analyzing, assessing how will this country react, what will happen next. At the same time, logics and facts, humanity and law, they no longer exist. They don't exist for the criminals in power. We pray for a positive end to the conflict. South Africa, the Houthis and Iran, they are the only heroes in the story. So, I mean, I would pose the question, I know you've touched on it just now, that another elephant in the room is that the world governments are actually supporting basically a business plan through Israel. It's land, oil, gas, ethnic cleansing. Financial gain is their motivator. And when financial gain is involved, then human nature will not give up under any circumstance. It doesn't matter how many deaths, what kind of havoc it wreaks. This is the only fact that matters. So my complaint is that why isn't this addressed directly? And my question, the second part of it is that what if we stop working through the established channels and fitting into the required narratives, wondering why we're in the same place? The definition of a democracy, isn't that the opposite of a dictatorship? And it feels like we are under a global dictatorship. I'm sure that the people in power want to change the status quo, and they would know how to. But there's a major hurdle in the fact that the UN has military power that it cannot use is that the P5 member states' consensus is impossible. So the present rules that we live under are corrupt and are essentially they're a cage for us. And they're not even being followed by Israel and the Western governments. What can the vast majority of the world who wants them changed, what can they do to change them?
And there's a term. Well, in two words, ma'am, popular power, people's power. We have to find ways to assert our popular power over the prevailing orthodoxy, which misgoverns us. And I'll come back to that, how we can do that, in a minute. But I'm one of these, and I've been, if you think about it, for more than half of my adult life, I have been sitting in the British Parliament, as I am again now. I've been a part of the debates in which this and that structure of so-called international law, of rules-based orders, and all the other guff that we hear endlessly, and I concluded long ago that all of this is just lipstick on a pig. And the point about lipstick is that it can be wiped off any time. It's there for the prettification of what is essentially a pig with all its ugliness. But if necessary, the lipstick can easily be wiped off. And we are seeing that now. You see, I'm so old, I remember when Britain prided itself on being not corrupt, unlike Johnny Foreigner, who was always said to be governed by corrupt politicians, corrupt governments, had an independent civil service which served the public and not any political party, which had a police force that you could safely anticipate that if your children were in trouble, the first thing they should do is ask a policeman. That had a court system that was independent from the political process and where you could expect justice. That had a BBC, which was the gold label of international journalism. That had an armed forces that were there to defend us and had defended us for a time alone against the Nazi hordes, that we had freedom of speech, that we had a genuine democracy. All of these things, every one of the things that I have just adumbrated, is now a shadow of its former self, except where it no longer exists at all, where no one even pretends that it exists. So I don't believe we're living either under the United Nations Charter of International Law, which was the pre-1999 spoken iteration of how we live, or a rules-based international order, leaving aside who made the rules, when were they made, who was consulted about, leave all that aside. Now they're no longer even pretending to adhere to any kind of rules. They break the rules they said yesterday were the rules that everyone must apply to. The best example this week, and there's an example every week, is the failure to condemn the destruction of the Iranian embassy consulate in Damascus. So we have to build an alternative power. We have to build an alternative media, and that's what I'm trying to do with this show, with the mother of all talk shows, with my social media platforms, and so on. We have to have a new political option on the ballot paper. Again, what I'm trying to do, I'm the leader of the Workers' Party of Britain. I'm trying to give the people somewhere else better to vote than the two cheeks of the same backside of the Uni Party. And we need to be demonstrating, as millions of people have all round the Western world for more than 6 months now, in the bitter cold of winter for the most part. We need to be boycotting, divesting, taking sanctions against the biggest criminals in the international arena. We need to be educating ourselves. I tell our young people in our party, read before you think, and think before you write, speak, and act. Thank you to all our panel. I think the best show we've had so far. Thank you to Professor Marandi for his expertise, and above all, thanks to you. Have it out with Galloway.
Thank you. Epistle of Life. The Sound of Living. Only sound will endure. IRIB English Radio. The Limelight.
There was no calls by Western leaders for restraint as Israel bombed Gaza into ruins week after week, striking its hospitals, leveling its government offices, blowing up its universities, mosques, and churches, and destroying its bakeries. Rather, President Biden has repeatedly rushed through emergency arms sales, bypassing Congress to make sure Israel has enough bombs to keep destroying Gaza and killing its children. Stay tuned for the first part of this article, please. Middle East Eye wrote, suddenly Western politicians from US President Joe Biden to British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak have become ardent champions of restraint in a very last-minute scramble to avoid regional conflagration. Iran launched a salvo of drones and missiles at Israel in a retaliatory move. The United Nations Security Council was hurriedly pressed into session, with Washington and its allies calling for a de-escalation of tensions that all could too easily lead to the outbreak of war across the West Asia region and beyond. The UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, told the meeting, neither the region nor the world can afford more war. Now is the time to defuse and de-escalate. The Zionist regime, meanwhile, vowed to exact the price against Iran at a time of its choosing, but the West's abrupt conversion to restraint needs some explaining. After all, Western leaders showed no restraint when the Zionist regime bombed Iran's consulate in Damascus, killing a senior general and more than a dozen other Iranians, the proximate cause of Tehran's retaliation. Under the Vienna Convention, the consulate is not only a protected diplomatic mission, but is viewed as sovereign Iranian territory. The Zionist regime's attack on it was an unbridled act of aggression, the supreme international crime, as the Nuremberg Tribunal ruled at the end of the Second World War. For that reason, Tehran invoked Article 51 of the United Nations Charter, which allows it to act in self-defense. And yet, rather than condemning the Zionist regime's dangerous belligerence, a flagrant attack on the so-called rules-based order, so revered by the US, Western leaders lined up behind Washington's favorite client state. At a Security Council meeting on April 4th, the US, Britain, and France intentionally spurned restraint by blocking a resolution that would have condemned Israel's attack on the Iranian consulate, a vote that, had it not been stymied, might have sufficed to placate Tehran. Recently, British Foreign Secretary David Cameron still gave the thumbs up to Israel's flattening of Iran's diplomatic premises, saying he could completely understand the frustration Israel feels, though he added, without any hint of awareness of his own hypocrisy, that the UK would take very strong action if a country bombed a British consulate. By shielding
the Zionist regime from any diplomatic consequences for its acts of war against Iran, the Western powers, in short Tehran, would have to pursue a military response instead. But it did not end there. Having stoked Iran's sense of grievance at the UN, Biden vowed ironclad support for the Israeli regime and grave consequences for Tehran should it dare to respond to the attack on its consulate. Iran ignored those threats. Recently, it launched hundreds of drones and missiles at the same time, protesting vociferously about the Security Council's inaction and silence, coupled with its failure to condemn the Israeli regime's aggressions. And Western leaders failed to take note. They again sided with Israel and denounced Tehran. At the recent Security Council meeting, the same three states, the US, the UK, and France, that had earlier blocked a statement condemning the Zionist regime's attack on Iran's diplomatic mission, sought a formal condemnation of Tehran for its response. Russia's ambassador to the UN, Vasily Nebenzia, ridiculed what he called the parade of Western hypocrisy and double standards. You know very well that an attack on a diplomatic mission is a casus belli under international law. And if Western missions were attacked, you would not hesitate to retaliate and prove your case in this room. There was no restraint visible either as the West publicly celebrated its collusion with Israel in foiling Iran's attack and thereby effectively making itself a direct party to this dangerous confrontation. The restraint the West demands relates only, it seems, to Iran's efforts to defend itself. Given the West's newfound recognition of the need for caution and the obvious dangers of military excess, now may be the time for its leaders to consider demanding restraint more generally and not just to avoid a further escalation between Iran and the child-killing regime of Israel. Over the past 6 months, the Zionist regime has bombed Gaza into rubble, destroyed its medical facilities and government offices, and murdered and maimed many, many tens of thousands of Palestinians. In truth, such is the devastation that Gaza some time ago lost the ability to count its dead and wounded. At the same time, the Zionist regime has intensified its 17-year blockade of the tiny enclave to the point where so little food and water are getting through. The population are in the grip of famine. People, especially children, are literally starving to death. The International Court of Justice, the world's highest court, chaired by an American judge, ruled back in January, when the situation was far less dire than it is now, that a plausible case had been made the Zionist regime was committing genocide, a crime against humanity strictly defined in international law. And yet, there were no calls by Western leaders for restraint as the Zionist regime bombed Gaza into ruins week after week, striking its hospitals, leveling its government offices, blowing up its universities, mosques, and churches, and destroying its bakeries. Rather, President Biden has repeatedly rushed through emergency arms sales, bypassing Congress to make sure the Zionist regime has enough bombs to keep destroying Gaza and killing its children. When the Zionist regime leaders vow to treat Gaza's population like human animals, denying them all food, water, and power, Western politicians gave their assent. Sunak was not interested in recruiting his brave RAF pilots to protect civilians in Gaza from Israel, and Starmer showed no concern about the fear and instability felt by Palestinians from Israel's reign of terror. Quite the reverse. Starmer, famed as a human rights lawyer, even gave his approval to Israel's collective punishment of the people of Gaza, its complete siege, as integral to a supposed Israeli right of self-defense. In doing so, he overturned one of the most fundamental principles of international law, that civilians should not be targeted for the actions of their leaders. As is now all too apparent, he confirmed a death sentence on the people of Gaza. Where was restraint then? Similarly, restraint went out of the window when Israel fabricated a pretext for eradicating the UN agency UNRWA, the last lifeline for Gaza's starving population. Even though the Zionist regime was unable to offer any evidence for its claim that a handful of UNRWA staff were implicated in an attack on Israel on October 7th, Western leaders hurriedly cut off funding to the agency. In doing so, they became actively complicit in what the World Court already feared was a genocide. Where was the restraint when Israeli officials, with a long history of lying to advance their regime's military agenda, made up stories about Hamas beheading babies or carrying out systematic rapes on October 7th? All of this was debunked by an Al Jazeera investigation drawing largely on the Israeli sources. Those genocide-justifying deceptions were all too readily amplified by Western politicians and media. The Zionist regime showed no restraint in destroying Gaza's hospitals or taking hostage and torturing thousands of Palestinians it grabbed off the street. All of that got a quiet nod from Western politicians. Where was the restraint in Western capitals when protesters took to the streets to call for a ceasefire, to stop Israel's bloodletting of women and children, the majority of Gaza's dead? The demonstrators were smeared, are still smeared by Western politicians as supporters of terrorism and anti-Semites. And where was the demand for restraint when the child-killing regime of Israel tore up the rule book on the laws of war, allowing every would-be strong man to recite the West's indulgence of Israeli atrocities as the precedent justifying their own crimes? On each occasion, when it favored Israel's malevolent goals, the West's commitment to restraint went missing in action.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. To all our brothers and sisters, listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing, where we discuss problems and questions parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. The answers are mostly based on the book Children in the Quran and Sunnah, compiled by Ayatollah Ray Shahri. And to help us with these questions, we have in the studio our guest speaker, Brother Miqdad, who is an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmi of Qom. Assalamu alaikum, Brother Miqdad. Thank you for coming over.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah. Thank you very much to you.
On the last episode, when we met each other, we were talking about the effects of animations. And we were trying to introduce the Ahlul Bayt as the role models to our children. But then we were worried about how animations might impede that goal, and they might even be better. But you said that the way to fight animations is stories. And you insisted, you emphasized on stories. So I want to start today's program by asking you, why stories? Why can stories, in your opinion, have such a huge impact? What quality do they have?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. All of us like stories. I mean, even adults. I mean, I don't know if you have experiences. You know, when you're in a lecture, for instance, and the lecture is going on and on and on, and suddenly you're thinking about different things, and your mind's absent-minded. The moment the person says, once upon a time, or one day there was a person, suddenly everybody's mind just comes and focuses. Oh, story time, right? We all love stories. We've been created in a way that we love stories. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala himself in the Holy Quran also tells us stories, a lot of stories. And what's interesting is that Allah says, I do the stories. نَحْنُ نَقُصُ عَلَيْكَ أَحْسَنَ الْقَصَصِ Right? That Allah is telling you a story. Right, and he's telling the story to the Prophet. And the Quran is full of stories. Right, if you remove the stories from the Quran, there's not much left in the Holy Quran. Right, so Allah Himself uses stories in the Quran to teach us, to the tarbiyah. The role of the Quran is to teach us. The role of the Quran is to guide us, is to do our tarbiyah. Right, and what is the way that the Quran uses? Is stories. Right, it tells us the stories of the Prophet. It tells us the stories of people, of bad people, of good people, of different things. Right, and through the stories is for what? لتفقهون. Right, so that they think, they realize, they ponder, they learn, and through that they can grow.
That's a very good point. I think one of the features of the stories is that we listen to it as a third party, so we're not worried about us being judged. And we judge the people in the story without the biases and the predilections that we come with.
Actually, I would say more than that is one of the things that story does is that it actually you make yourself in the shoes of the person who is going on the story. And that's very interesting because the better when the story is told in a very beautiful way, what happens is that the person who's listening feels that I am that person, I am that hero, right? I don't know if you've heard different stories, how many stories you've heard, but whenever you hear, and we do this even when we look at cartoons and movies, right? Because at the end of the animations are also kind of a story, right? You feel that you're the superhero. I've seen kids, when they watch cartoon, they're actually standing, right? And the moment the guy takes his sword out, they're taking their sword out as well, right? They're in it, right? And they're in the shoes of that superhero. Now imagine that you tell the story of Amirul Mu'mineen in the same way, right? That person thinks that I am Ali. And the moment he says, I am Ali, then the ideology come with it, the values come with it, and the personality is becoming an Ali personality.
Thank you very much. That was a very nice answer. Let's take a break. After the break, we're going to start by asking, when is the right time to begin telling stories? Stay tuned.
Wait, stop! I got a better game!
IRIB English Radio presents a priceless gift to parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5-year-old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry, we're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. English radio at irib.ir.
You're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic Upbringing. We're talking about how to introduce the Ahlul Bayt as role models to our children. And one of the things that we're focusing on is telling stories. So we said that stories have a huge impact on children. When would be the right time for us to start telling our children stories of the Ahlul Bayt?
Just before I answer that, just a very quick point about the last point. So we said that stories is very, very powerful because it plays on the imagination, right? You're working on the imagination of the child. And through this imagination, you're putting the child in the shoes of that superhero, of that person that the story is about, right? And that removes all time and all distances, right? You've made the person make him that hero. That's a very important point. There is no time, there is no space distances between the two people. And so you realize that very often stories go a much stronger way than any type of advice or counseling or telling off, right? You can tell a child, you can sit him down and say, I advise you, oh my son, that you should do this and that, right? And you tell him a story about somebody that he's going to love or she's going to love, right? It works a million times better. When do we start saying stories to children, stories about the Ahlul Bayt? As soon as a child is able to communicate with you and can have a relationship with what you're saying, understand what you're saying, not just the words that you're using, but also your facial expression, your hand movement. As soon as a child is able to understand these things, you should start saying stories. Obviously, the stories that you say for a two-year-old are different than the stories you can say for an eight-year-old, right? In terms of depth, in terms of content, etc. But stories should start as early as two or three.
But you mean as early as two or three? I'm thinking about my siblings, and at that age, we're normally talking about the cat that listened to her mother, because they have a better understanding, grasp of what a cat is, rather than the Ahlul Bayt. It's something very, very, I think, untangible for them.
Two things. One is goes back to what we mentioned about the fitrah, right? We said that the Ahlul Bayt are that which a person is thirsty for, right? Because it's our fitrah. So a child, even at two, will recognize the Ahlul Bayt the moment you mention them. And secondly, remember, if you use stories, then you're using stories that that child at 2 years is able to understand, right? I'm not saying that you mentioned about the hadith of Mi'raj, for example. Obviously, a two-year-old woman won't understand that. But you can talk about very simple stories that about the Ahlul Bayt. The fact that, for example, that when Amirul Mu'mineen wanted to share honey between different people, he took the lids of the honey bottle and he gave it to the children. And the children felt so happy that they received lids of honey from Amir al-Mu'mineen, and they were licking the lids whilst Amir al-Mu'mineen was doing his work. A very simple, very short story. If you say it very well, a two-year-old understands.
And how should we select the stories? You kind of actually answered that question, but how should we select, what criteria should we have in selecting the stories that we want to tell our children?
One of the very important things when we're choosing stories is that we have to bring about stories that focus on both the physical and material aspects of the Ahlul Bayt, such as their generosity, their physical strength, their cleverness in doing things, their kindness to people, their respect to children, for instance, etc., etc. But at the same time, we have to also introduce the spiritual aspect of the Ahlul Bayt, the aspect that are not in line with physical rules and the physical material world, right? Such as the miracles that the Ahlul Bayt did, such as things that are completely not understandable by any science of today, right? These things also need to be introduced to our children. And this perhaps is going to be the key in making our children role models.
Okay, thank you very much. We're going to go for a break now, but we will be back very soon. Don't go away.
Ya muqiyal khayrat, ya muqiyal khayrat.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, he who has a child must treat him in a childish manner.
Ya muqiyal khayrat, ya muqiyal khayrat.
You're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic Upbringing with Brother Miqdad. We're talking about the effect of stories, how to tell stories, how to select them. And I'd like to ask you my final question for the final segment of our program. Now that we know when to start telling stories, how to select them, the question is, how should we narrate these stories to our children? Specifically, I'm asking about techniques and methods.
Okay, a couple of very practical tips. Firstly, we should use words that children understand, right? We should speak the words of children. Use simple words, use words that children use all the time. And this means you have to have a very strong relationship with children. You have to be with children, right? If you're not with children, you won't know how they speak. Unfortunately, today in today's world, we don't often speak to our children, or we don't often listen to our children. It's very important to listen to them, right? Listen to them, listen to how they speak, so you can know what kind of words to use and what kind of things that they say, so that you can use them in your stories as well. Second is, try and always choose sentences that are short, that are easy to understand, and the links between sentences are very close by. Not that you say something now and then you want to explain it 3 sentences later, right? Thirdly is that the tune and the tone that you use, the body language, the change of voice is extremely important, right? We have to make stories as attractive as possible. The speed at which you say things, the tone and the tune that you use, the loud of the voice, the pitch of the voice, these are very important things that make sure that the story is lively. So you don't recite stories whilst lying down, for example. You have to be sitting, even standing at times. And you have to do the movements, right? When Amir al-Mu'min is in Badr, for example, he's fighting, he jumps on his horse and and he takes out his sword, right? You've got the noise as well. You've got the gestures, you've got the whole thing. Children feel mesmerized by your stories. I'll give more examples as we go along. Inshallah, in the next session, I'll bring more stories to discuss as well. Another thing that's very important is to make sure that you finish the story always. Never leave suspense. Children can't bear suspense. You finish the story. Another thing that you could do as well is use songs and poetry. Now, English has kind of a weakness in that, but we have a lot of stories, a lot of songs and rhymes out there, Islamic rhymes that are related to the Ahlul Bayt that you could use. And lastly, you could bring the children also part of the story as well. Let them finish sentences, for instance. Or ask them, you can make the noise, for example, or you can do that gesture, for example. Bring them in. One last point before we end is that do not feel shy or do not hesitate to repeat the story 100 times. Children like repeating stories, right? You might feel tired after the 20th time you said the story. Say it again. It's not a problem. Children actually love to hear stories time and time over again.
I must have been like 3 or 4 years old when one of our relatives, my cousin's father, he would gather us around himself and while giving us lunch, tell us some very nice stories of the Ahlul Bayt. And to this day, I still remember those stories and those moments, very sweet moments. Thank you very much, Brother Maghdad. If you have children, enjoy their company. It's one of the best things that can happen in your life. And raise them with the muhabba, with the love of the Ahlul Bayt, alayhim as-salam. That's all the time that we have. We have to sign off now. If you missed the program, you can always download an archive of this episode and previous ones from our website. Simply visit parstoday.com. That's parstoday.com and find our page, Call of Islam. Also, you can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. That's englishradio@irib.ir. Until next episode, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Islam solves all of its problems, Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is the way of life. A complete way, it's a complete way.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 31 meters, 9650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
We'll be right back. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.